From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. In 1973, my guest director, John Landis, loved horror movies so much that he made his first film a tribute to those films, a film called Schlock. In the intervening years, he's made many great movies, Coming to America and The Blues Brothers, but he's also gone back to horror with films such as American Werewolf in London and Innocent Blood. He has finally let his inner film historian out for his book, Monsters in the Movies. John, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you. You know, actually, Schlock was made in 1971, but I didn't get a distributor until 73. So it's it always says 73.
Well, 73 is when I saw, but forgive me.
No.
Here in the hinterlands in Detroit, we're not
hipsters, you know what?
Like you're here in Los Angeles.
I had to go. I didn't have to go, but I was able to go on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show to promote Schlock. And I remember I was almost 23 and I had to lie and say I was 21 because that's how old I was when I made the movie, and that was the hook, you know.
Well, getting back to this terrific book, Monsters in the Movies, 100 Years of Monsters, what made you decide to do this book at this point? Is it just for the centenary or?
No, it was that I was in London making a film. Burke and Hare, which it's just this week comes out on DVD in the States.
Why isn't that released in the States?
It was. It played at the IFC. IFC picked it up for the U.S. and it played at the IFC Theater in Manhattan. And I've heard of dates here and there, but it was weird. It's like an art house movie here. It's kind of bizarre.
And by the way, a remake.
It's not a remake.
But you're using the same title, right? There's like
No, they're like four Burke and Hare movies. Actually, I should correct that. There are 17 movies about Burke and Hare. Four of them are called Burke and Hare.
Yes.
Obviously, you haven't seen it. So
no, I haven't seen it.
The story of Burke and Hare. And ironically, our film is by far the most historically accurate. Burke and Hare were two Irish serial killers in Edinburgh in 1828. Edinburgh was the center of medical research in the world at that time. And to teach surgery and anatomy, just like now, you need cadavers. Then cadavers were not easy to come by. You only got them from the state, which meant, you know, people who died in prison or executed prisoners or indigents on the street. That was it. So one, the bodies were in pretty bad shape. And two, there were not enough of them to go around for all the teaching institutions. And the true story is pretty grisly. Dr. Knox, distinguished doctor, and another Dr. Munro played in my film. Dr. Knox is Tom Wilkinson and Dr. Munro is Tim Curry. They let it be known that they would pay for fresh bodies. And this began body snatching, grave robbing, like the beginning of Frankenstein. We see him digging up the body. And Robert Louis Stevenson wrote The Body Snatcher based on Burke and Hare. And what these guys did was they eliminated the middleman. They just murdered people and sold the bodies with the knowledge of the doctors.
Which in this movie, I guess, is evident rather than some of the other movies kind of play around with the truth a little bit.
Oh, a lot. Yeah. Well, no. This movie, the facts are quite correct in this movie. There's a lot of added stuff. But the facts are correct. And the difference is that we don't play them as the loathsome monsters they, in fact, were. We make them kind of charming leading men.
And evidenced by Simon Pegg and Nick Frost being in the lead.
Well, not Nick Frost. Simon Pegg and Andy Serkis.
Andy Serkis.
It's just a perverted notion. It's like making a romantic comedy out of Charles Manson. It's just a very a very subversive and bizarre idea. And that's it's Isla Fisher and Jessica Stevenson and wonderful cast and Christopher Lee. And
who's interviewed in your book, Monsters in the Movies.
Right. You know, Chris is one of the few guys to have played almost every monster.
That's true. Well, we should say, by the way, my guest is John Landis. In addition to being a great film director, he's let us know he's a film historian with his terrific picture book, Monsters in the Movies. One of the things, though, just mentioning remakes, there's so much sort of an echo chamber in the history of horror. I mean, you go into real detail talking about how something that most people don't think about, Carmilla is really the first vampire story, and Dracula came almost 30 years after that.
Right.
And then Also saying something too, which I didn't know, was that there was like a legal battle over Nosferatu on his release.
Oh, Nosferatu, most of the prints were destroyed because Nosferatu is a complete ripoff of Dracula.
That I knew. But
and Bram Stoker's widow sued for many years, and it's only because of a film archive, I think, in Norway that a print exists at all.
Just so you know, I did read your book.
Yeah, there you go.
But, I mean, it's fascinating to this sort of historical thing. And the terrific interviews, Guillermo del Toro, David Cronenberg, Rick Baker, Christopher Lee. What's fascinating, too, is that some of these people, Joe Dante, most people don't know them as being horror people anymore. I mean, nobody remembers that David Cronenberg got his start in horror.
Well, most of David's films are what he calls body horror.
Yeah. I mean, you go up until basically The Fly, which is now – it'll be 25 years next year.
Well, you could talk about Crash as kind of – or even Naked Lunch had its monsters in it.
Yeah, but he really moved away from that. And so many – as you mentioned when you
I don't think he moved away from it at all.
Would you say A Dangerous Method is
– Have you seen it?
He was here talking about it.
Well,
of course I've
you know
seen it.
What's Dangerous Method about.
It's certainly about that fear of the body, which runs through all of his movies.
It's about madness.
But one of the things, though, you get to when you're talking to Guillermo del Toro is that so many people came out of this, Coppola and yourself. So many people got their starts in horror, then moved into something else.
Well, because of exploitation. I mean, the easiest—
Sam Raimi, for example, being somebody that most people wouldn't even know was a horror director.
Oh, Sam made some of the most important ones.
I'm from Detroit, so I know
yeah,
about these movies.
Sure. So many people, Bogdanovich, I mean, so many people started in horror because horror is part of exploitation. And you could, until recently, actually, now the whole everything's in chaos, but it used to be that if you made a movie with a monster in it, you could get it distributed.
Because there was a whole circuit.
Sure, and it was not that the most discerning audience. I mean, the miracle is how many good movies have been made with monsters in it, where the vast majority are just terrible, you know, because they were exploitation.
But what genre couldn't you say that about, really, finally? I mean,
that the majority are terrible?
Yes. And you know what? Don't even answer it right away. We still have another 25
All right.
minutes to go.
Well,
I
want to answer your question. We got sidetracked. I was in London making this movie, and in England, An American Werewolf in London is this very big movie. I mean, it's like ridiculous. It's like the Blues Brothers is in Chicago. That's what Werewolf is in England, you know. So I was approached while I was there. The year I was there, I was approached by like 10 publishers. Would I write a book on the best horror films or 10 best horror? I hate those list books. You know, I really dislike them. But I was approached by the Cobalt Collection, which is the largest archive of motion picture stills in the world. It was started by John Cobalt in the late 50s. He was literally a dumpster diver. He would, you know, because the studios threw this stuff out. And in any case, the Cobalt Collection is by far the largest archive of motion picture stills. And they said, would you do a book on anything you'd like? So I thought, well, they want me to do horror, and I'm not, you know, the horror, I'm like Karloff or Vincent Price or Chris Lee. No one likes that name, horror films, because horror, to horrify someone, is easy. I mean, there's no skill involved in horror because you just show something horrific. And the audience is you show a shredded puppy and you got a horrified audience. So you watch the Republican debates. You know, it's not hard to horrify people. To create genuine shock and suspense is hard. Karloff wanted to call them terror films. And Chris Lee likes the French, fantastique, you know. But regardless, I thought, you know, monsters, just a monster itself, a monster, it crosses all genres. I mean, Bergman films have monsters in them. Fellini films have monsters in them. So it's not just horror. It's also science fiction, fantasy, fairy tales. Disney is monsters galore.
Oh, my God, yes.
So that's the subject I took.
It's The Treatment, not Meet the Press. My guess is John Landis, his new book, is Monsters in the Movies. And you say something really interesting in the book. You talk about your wife, Deborah, and you say that she'll watch anything but movies with real life monsters,
well,
if you will, such as The
Werewolves,
Boston Strangler
right.
or Silence of the Lambs.
Because werewolves and vampires and demons and all these things, witches, warlocks, you know, dinosaurs, they're not real. They do not exist. When you have a movie like Psycho or Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Silence of the Lambs, those are psychotics and serial killers, and those are quite real. And so my wife, I use her as an example. There are many people like this. They have no problem with a vampire, no problem with, you know, the Frankenstein monster or anything like that. They can watch gorillas rampaging without it. But a serial killer is too creepy for them. They can't deal with it.
Well, so could you ask this question of a lot of people in the book? I'll ask it of you. To you, what defines a monster?
Ah, well, that the most interesting thing to me in the book was the interviews with, you know, Rick Baker and Ray Harryhausen and the others you mentioned. They all had different definitions.
Yeah.
And a monster, ultimately, people hear the word monster and they think, well, evil, sinister, bad. But in fact, many monsters are sympathetic. You know, and 50% of the monsters in the book are victims. The Frankenstein monster
basically,
is a victim.
Basically, almost every werewolf is a victim. Okay,
well, it depends. That's an interesting thing. Kurt Siodmak, who was a screenwriter, a refugee from Hitler, he wrote The Wolfman. And The Wolfman is the first time a werewolf is presented as a victim. Up until then, like in Dracula in the book, Dracula can turn into a wolf at will.
Yes.
Werewolves
which
usually –
which he does in the Coppola's Dracula.
Right. Well, usually they were evil. Witches or warlocks or people who turned into wolves and they were bad. Siodmak's idea was that it was like a disease. The werewolf is the victim. The wolf man, Larry Talbot, is a victim of this bizarre thing, and it's like cancer. I mean, it's not only a cancer that kills him, it kills others. It's not like Jekyll and Hyde. In Jekyll and Hyde, the Stevenson story, that talks about the evil inside the person, or the, you know, or in Dr. Moreau, the stubborn beast flesh. It's the evil within us. Whereas the Wolfman, the evil is completely other.
And you, as is mentioned in the book, when you talk to a number of people, so many people say the most terrifying thing is in the Wolfman when he doesn't wake up, and when he wakes up rather, and he doesn't remember anything.
Right. Well, that's taken from Siodmak. I mean, that's another point that I found doing the research in the book, which is so much of what we accept as folklore or traditional ancient, you know, tales and mythology was invented by screenwriters recently.
You talk about that basically sort of the sliding rule of how you deal with werewolves and vampires.
Well,
in the
every single film, regardless of genre, by the way, but every film creates its own rules. And it's the rules for that film that it has to live by. It's interesting. It's like movie physics. You know, there's some movies where you'll accept impossible feats of, you know, people leaping around, and other movies where you won't. And they go, oh, that's ridiculous. But why is it not ridiculous in the other movie? It's how successfully the filmmaker has created the reality of that individual story.
As you talk about this, so much of – I want to get your sense of, to you, what defines a monster.
Well, a monster is, for me, is many things. I personally think that monsters are often physically grotesque. Here you go. Now, look, it says, quoting from my own book.
According to John Landis.
According to John Landis. the word monster comes from the Latin monstrum. Monstrous means a perversion of the natural order, usually biological. The word monster is associated with something that is wrong or sinister. A monster is either physically or mentally detestable, often an aberration in appearance and behavior. The word monster is generally associated with the concept of evil, both in thought and action. Normal-looking people who behave in reprehensible ways are also referred to as monsters. Now, what's interesting about that definition is what about the monsters in Monsters, Inc.? Who are sweet.
Yes. You know? Yes, they're who monsters for a living.
Right.
They literally punch a clock.
So what happens with rules, it's like, you know, the only generalization that I believe to be true is never generalize.
That's something to give the audience to think about. We'll take a break. My guest is director and film historian John Landis. His new book, terrific, beautiful book, is Monsters in the Movies. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Rattlett, producer of The Treatment. If you like our show, you might also like The Business, KCRW's show about the business of show business, hosted by Kim Masters of The Hollywood Reporter. Find it on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. When I last left my guest director, John Landis, he was talking about monsters because it's the subject of his book, Monsters in the Movies. But what I want to ask you about, and the thing I found the most fascinating, is the chapter on zombies, I mean, because basically zombies have probably changed more than anything else in the movies. I mean, they start off as being just these sort of creepy things.
Well, first
didn't
of all,
the
zombies are real. I mean, the Haitian voodoo zombie.
You go into the whole history of Baron Samedi and how movies use that. And then by the 1960s, zombies became something else. Basically, movies claimed zombies in this way. And for me, that was the most interesting chapter of the book.
All monsters are metaphors. In fact, Joe Dante suggests a game. Name the monster, name the metaphor. For instance, I mean, an obvious one, Godzilla, where you have Japan, the only country ever to have atomic bombs dropped on it, within 10 years makes a film about this prehistoric dragon that is radioactive, breathes fire, and destroys cities. I mean, that's not a reach. It's fascinating. And in terms of zombies, the evolution of zombies where, you know, Romero is the one who really did the – remember Pogo, the comic strip? And Pogo,
he mentioned that in the book.
He says we have met the enemy and they are us.
He is us.
And what Romero did is he made zombies – he called them blue-collar zombies, just regular people. And what do they represent? Well, clearly zombies are the monster of the 21st century. I mean, there's so many zombie movies. I think there are 11 zombie movies right now in various stages of production, including one with Brad Pitt that's like a $200 million movie.
Oh, yeah, World War Z.
It's like this tremendous rush with zombies. And I think, I mean, in my own opinion, zombies have come to represent chaos and anarchy and the loss of social order. And I think that's probably why they're so popular right now, because that's what's going on around the world, the loss of structure and order, and people are very nervous. People are scared about what's going on.
Because as you talk about that, the reason I like this chapter so much, you made me think that zombies are really a post-World War II thing, because coming back from World War II, and there are certain freedoms that people just couldn't fight anymore, and the threat of communism was a threat from without, but also civil rights, rights being extended to women. The white man's hegemony kind of ended, and it was the most fearsome thing to have that sort of dominance taken away from you.
Absolutely. And one of the phenomenons of humanity, of us as people, as a species, I don't think people can accept that they don't know. I mean, when we don't know, we make it up. So, for instance, no one knows what it's like after death. So what do? We invent philosophies and religions that tell us what happened after death. Death is so terrifying, the finality of death and the fact that we can't deal with it. We have ghosts and we have all kinds of things, angels, all kinds of ways to deal with death. And one of the most interesting is, who's the first zombie in our culture? Lazarus. You know, Jesus made him come back from the dead. And he walked in, you know, he was alive again. And it's so fascinating about the walking dead, the living dead. And I'm just fascinated. I mean, then you get into, I was interested, so if you kill a zombie, can you have a ghost zombie? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, what are the rules?
It's The Treatment, by the way. I'm talking to my guest, John Landis, about his book, Monsters in the Movies. For me, that's fascinating, too, because I think zombies are really the first time where you start to see interracial movement in movies, right down to George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, which is the first movie with a black hero, and his race is never mentioned.
That was really remarkable where in Night of the Living Dead, I remember seeing it on Hollywood Boulevard and realizing as I was watching it, this guy's the hero of the piece, and which made the ending all the more shocking to me.
I mean, it still works as that kind of metaphor over 40 years later.
Well, monster movies are metaphors. Monsters are metaphors, all of them. I mean, there was a huge renaissance in vampires with the AIDS epidemic. And that's obvious. I mean, that's a transparent disease spread through bodily fluids. I mean, there's – right now we have all this – the new vampire movies, the Twilight movies.
And Cronenberg has a great line about it. He said, "But too much empathy? There can be too much empathy for these creatures?"
Well, he said they're not scary. They're pathetic. He said they're handicapped. What I find interesting about the Twilight movies, and it's very straightforward. I mean, the author is a devout Mormon who makes no bones about it. These are movies about abstinence, you know, and profoundly strange. And the fact that
they're
so successful, these films. They obviously are touching a nerve somewhere.
But what these monster movies really didn't reflect the sexual mores of their time. And there's now an ambivalence about being chaste and virginal versus being more forward-thinking in terms of one's pursuit of sexuality. And these movies, at one point or another, all sort of deal with that, don't they?
Well, vampires are intensely sexual and always have been.
And there's that great interview you do with Chris Farley. He talks about leaping across the table. I didn't realize that was all in one take and that he couldn't see when he did that.
Yeah, he was wearing those lenses. But still, that one of the, you know, Chris Lee was the first vampire in the movies to have fangs. Vampires never had – Bela Lugosi never had fangs. You know, it's just silly stuff like that where you just realize, hey, wait a minute. I mean, there's so many things about all the monsters in terms of like you go – one of the more interesting monsters to me is the machine where you get these intelligent – what we call artificial intelligence now. But there are many movies – there's HAL in 2001, Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Who bored people to death.
Well, you know what? All of them deal with the same thing, which is computers coming to the conclusion that humans are incapable of managing their own affairs.
Here's a question I actually want to ask, getting back to zombies again.
You're preoccupied with these zombies, Elvis.
I can't help it. You know, black people got to be in horror movies, for God's sake. Of course I'm preoccupied with them. But you talk about Richard Matheson, who comes up enormous number of times.
Yeah, amazingly influential.
And that's one to get to. I mean, just you talking about literary, how he may have been the biggest influence on basically movies from the 50s on.
What Richard Matheson did in I Am Legend, which was really an interesting thing, it's a book about a man. It's been made into three films.
You can still make a movie out of that book.
Exactly.
The last page of that book. You talk about the power of Dracula. The last paragraph of I Am Legend will make you weep.
Well, it's what's so wonderful powerful. Is it's a guy who survives a plague that's turning everyone into nocturnal vampires, bloodsuckers. And he basically spends his days finding these, you know, monsters that live in the dark and killing them.
And foraging for food.
His knights hold up in this fortress. But at the end of the book, he realizes that the vampires out there have generated
he's become the Scourge.
He's the monster.
Yes, I mean that's why what that title means is so heartbreaking. By the way, this isn't a book club. It's the treatment. My guest is John Landis. He's talking about his terrific book,
but
Monsters
you know what's
in the
funny?
Movies.
You're absolutely right. There have been three feature films made of that book, and none of them have done the book.
You could still make one because, I mean, again, I remember that was one of the first books I read that really scared me. And it's really short. It's about 95 pages. And that last page is so profoundly heartbreaking.
Well, Matheson is often profound, you know. I mean, like The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Sure.
The ending is truly profound. It becomes totally philosophical about your place in the universe. And it's extraordinary.
It's amazing, too, how much you were talking about politics earlier, about how much – we can sort of see the shift in politics in horror movies too. Is there's like those horror movies of the 70s, and you first started to make films like The Last House on the Left, and all those movies are really very much dealt with. I mean, they were incredibly political. And what was probably fun about that, and you get to in the book, is that monster movies for a long time existed as a subculture that you could define yourself by your relationship to and be away from the mainstream. And now they're completely inhabited the mainstream.
Well, what is bizarre is that the B picture has taken over. Now the studios are making these B and C pictures with A budgets. You know, making these silly monster movies with $100 million, things that used to be made in, you know, Corman would make in 7 days.
Yeah, but wasn't it – and you sort of get to that, you know, that the real fun of this and all the filmmakers you talk to basically say exactly the same thing. The fun was being able to make them for no money and also go out and discover them.
You know, well, there's so many. It's very much, you know, I remember when Tim Burton made Ed Wood, there was this kind of bizarre reaction from people like Joe Dante or myself or, you know, or John Waters, where we thought, hey, he's our secret. You know, and the fact that Ed Wood became mainstream was so bizarre. You know, that's a wonderful movie that Tim made, but, you know, he just suddenly, the New York Times is talking about Ed Wood.
But, I mean, doesn't it feel like it's this weird thing now where, you know, basically what was kind of a cult culture is now leading the culture?
Well, what's sad is it's leading the culture for many of the reasons that it was exploitation to begin with. I mean, part of globalization is when you open a movie now, it has to open in Shanghai and Barcelona and St. Louis and San Francisco and Botswana at the same time. So that's why we're making all these action pictures and easily understandable concepts. I mean, the Transformer movies are the perfect international movies because you need no brain to follow them. I'm serious. You know, it's like, you know, science fiction and fantasy is international. It's something in all cultures. And It's the rise. You know, for me, a part of this thing scares me is the rise of fundamentalism around the world, whether Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, I don't care what it is. I mean, a fundamentally held religious belief is a license to kill because it's my God and your God. And it goes back to this tribal. That's why monster movies speak to me, because they're so monster movies are so profound in their, again, the word, I guess the only word I come up with is metaphor. But they represent so many things.
But I think to me the most amazing thing about the book, before we go, is Chris Lee telling you he made 750 pounds.
Isn't that shocking?
Movies.
Yeah, for Dracula. I mean, that was a huge international hit and he got nothing. Sound familiar? But one of the things I want to stress also about the book, we're making it sound so ponderous, but there's a tremendous amount of pictures in there and stuff just because they're silly.
I think we're laughing the entire conversation. I think that's the wrong definition of ponderous. I think there's a real sense of pleasure from both you as a fan and a filmmaker and from also the guys you talk to in the book. I mean, it's the thing that I think as much as any other genre, people are drawn to because they really, really love it.
Well, one of the things I enjoy in the book also is David Cronenberg is one of the smartest guys I know and a truly funny guy. But if you read the piece in here, he won't accept that The Fly is a mad scientist movie. He won't accept it. He's just fighting all he can because, you know, one of the problems – not problems. One of the tropes of the mad scientist film is always this cliche. They're very conservative movies. There's some things man is not meant to know. And you don't fool around with God's work and almost always end badly. And David's trying to defend The Fly, which, by the way, is a wonderful movie.
And he keeps saying, I'm an atheist, by the way.
Yeah, but I said, so what? You know, in his movie, The Fly, which is inherent in the material, you know, Seth Brundle is experimenting in places he should not go, and he dies.
And he suffers as a result of it.
It ends badly, and David won't admit it, won't admit it. It's very, very funny. He's a great speaker. Del Toro, another one. These guys are so smart.
And incredibly thoughtful about what that. I mean, they come, each of these people, even Rick Baker and Chris Lee, with a real point of view that they bring to this.
Ray Harryhausen, who will not accept. Ray was interesting to me because this brilliant animator responsible for so many unforgettable monsters, you know. Ray says, and he's very sincere. Ray, by the way, is 99 now. No, 90, I've forgotten.
In his 90s.
And he's in his 90s. But Ray says none of his creatures are monsters. They're just behaving as they behave. You know, if you're a dinosaur, you eat people.
It's a very simple philosophy. Again, these are philosophical things. John, we're out of time. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you very much, Elvis.
My guest is John Landis. His terrific book, which is not ponderous by any means and has a lot of beautiful pictures, is Monsters in the Movie. Our recording engineer at KCRW, who also edits and mixes the show, is J.C. Swark. The associate producer is Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Rawr. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.